This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Introduced by Moshe to Sichon, the king of the Emori. This is in chapter 21, verse 21, where he asks permission to pass through the land of the Emorim. And he says the same as he said with Moab, that they won't drink any of their water, they'll go along the highway, and they won't cause any inconvenience. And Sichon gathers his army to go out to meet the Jewish people. Moshe refers to this incident again in the second chapter of Dvorim, where he says, firstly, in chapter 2, verse 24, Moshe is repeating God's instruction to the people, Kumusu'u v'ivru es nachal Arnon, get up and travel and cross the river of Arnon. See, I have given into your hand Sichon, the king of Cheshbon, the Emori, and his land. Hochel Rosh, go in, begin, and conquer it. Behisgor boi milchomo, and make war with him. And then a little bit later, in verse 26, and I send messengers from the Midbar Kedemos to Sichon, the king of Cheshbon, Divrei Shalom, a petition for peace. Lema, to say, Ebro ba'artucho, b'derech ba'derech ilech, lo yasu yaminu smol, the same as we have in our Sedra. Asks the Ramban in Dvorim, what does this mean? God says, I've given Sichon into your hands, go and conquer him. And Moshe, without God instructing him, sends messengers to ask for peace. Says the Ramban Limanafshach. If they're going to accept the peace, it's going to come out that God was a liar, Chas v'Shalom. God said, go and conquer them and take over the land. What would he do if Sichon said, right, peace, we'll have peace? Then you couldn't conquer him. And if you'll say that it was clear to everybody that no ways would Sichon accept the peace offer, what is Moshe doing making the offer? Trying to play tricks? Is he pretending that he's willing to look at peace when he isn't looking at peace? And when he knows there's no possibility of looking at peace? Therefore concludes the Ramban that the order should be inversed. First, Moshe sent messengers to Sichon asking for peace. Sichon turned them down, and then God says, now I've given them into your hands, go and conquer them. That's the order it should be. Why then, says the Ramban, does Moshe reverse the order? Why does he tell us first that God told him that he would conquer Sichon, and only afterwards does he tell us that he sent the messengers? Just so that we should know that in any event it was decided before that Sichon was not going to sue for peace, was not going to accept any peace offers, and that Sichon was in fact going to fight. So that was destined. And they asked the same questions as they asked about Paro, if he didn't have any free choice and all that kind of thing, because the pasuk itself says, Moshe himself says, "V'loy ovo Sichon melech Cheshbon in ha'avireinu bo." And Sichon, the king of Cheshbon, did not want to let us pass through his land. Ki hiksho Hashem Elokecho es ruchei, because Hashem your God hardened his spirit, ve'imetz et levovo, and gave him foolish courage, l'man titoi ve'yodcho kayom hazeh, so that you should conquer him today. So it was predestined that Sichon was not going to give in, that Sichon was going to fight. But nevertheless, they went first before God told Moshe that there was going to be a fight. Moshe offered for peace first. The Akedo in our Sedra doesn't like that at all. He doesn't quote the Ramban, but it's clear from his pshat in the parasha here and in Dvorim that he doesn't take it that way. He takes it in fact that God did tell Moshe before that Sichron was not going to give in, and that the country was his. Alei Rash, go and conquer the country. Vizgorem Milchomo, and make war with them. And then, after that instruction, Moshe sent for peace. Which means the Akedah has to contend with the Ramban's kashis, the Ramban's questions. Says the Akedah, in another place, this is the Akedah in Shair 81. In Shair 74, quite a way back, the Akedah lays a principle as to the meaning of peace. Shalom. And he says, Shalom is not like Busha. Busha means shame, embarrassment. Now Busha, as you know, is considered one of the positive middos, it's one of the positive attributes of the Jewish people. By Shonim, we're ashamed. Says the Akedah, Busha, yes, it's a positive middah if you've done wrong. But if you have nothing to be ashamed of, there theoretically wouldn't be such a thing as Busha. The first time we encounter the middah of Busha in the Torah is after Adam has sinned. After Adam and Chava has sinned, then it says they felt Busha. But up until that point, the concept of Busha didn't exist. Because Busha, embarrassment, is the acknowledgement of a feeling of inadequacy. It's a feeling of the gap between what I am and what I should be. That's what Busha is. But before there was chet, before anybody did anything wrong, there was no gap between what I was and what I should have been. I was what I should be. My full potential was being reached. And when your full potential is being reached, there's no place for Busha. So Busha is a strange middah. It's a very positive middah, but only after the chet. It's a middah which implies previous sin. Having sinned, Busha is an important middah. Likewise, says the Akedah in Shair 74, you might think that Shalom, peace, implies a previous argument. Who do you make peace with? You make peace with somebody that you have fought with. But if you haven't fought with anybody, you don't have to make peace. Says the Akedah, that's all wrong. Shalom, peace, is not a consequence of an argument. Shalom is something which exists completely independently of an argument, independently of a war, independently of a machlokes. Shalom is a concept all on its own. And one should really go through all the hundreds of chazal that talk about peace to see the extent to which peace is praised and the way it's talked about. It's one of the most important things that there are. The Akedah says basically it's without Shalom, nothing can really happen. If people aren't interrelating with one another in a peaceful way, then everything else cracks up. The whole Torah assumes Shalom to start with. Otherwise, the Torah doesn't begin to operate. He sees Shalom as one of the most fundamental principles in people living together, which is the first requirement of a Torah life. And therefore, he says, not only, this is a big chiddush, let me introduce it, by a problem which many people experience, particularly in South Africa today and in other countries. It was raised with me by a non-Jewish person recently, who said that he has problems with his son, who's out on the border killing terrorists and losing his sensitivity. Killing is no longer that terrible a thing to him. He's got used to it. Human life is not that precious to him anymore. And he was lost as to what to do about it. The approach that I've always taken with these things is that one has to look at it in the same way as one looks at a glass being half empty or half full. Is he killing terrorists or is he saving civilians? Which one is it? The din is that if there's a snake, you've got to kill the snake. Why? Because if you don't kill the snake's likely to bite somebody else. Or a scorpion. Anything dangerous, which you know is likely to cause trouble to other innocent people, Hashkem v'horgo, you've got to get in first and you have to kill him. It doesn't apply only to snakes and scorpions, it's habol lahorgecho. If somebody is coming with the intent of killing you, Hashkem v'horgo, you get in first and kill him. That's not called killing, that's called saving, that's pikuach nefesh. That's not retzach, that's not murder. If somebody sneaks into your house and you know that if they find you they're going to kill you, they're not going to allow a confrontation to go past and sit and negotiate with you. They're armed. Somebody comes into your house armed and you have a gun, you're fully entitled to take the gun out and shoot him dead. That's says, and you don't have to worry about anything. It's not murder, it's a big mitzvah that you've done. You've been mekayim, the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh, you saved the person. So I said to this non-Jewish person, as I've said to many others who are faced with the same problem, you have to gear yourself and you have to gear your children before they go out into the army as to the magnitude of the mitzvah that they're in fact doing. If they're going out there to ensure that people who are have the intent of killing innocent people, if they can penetrate past those lines, and they are being mashkim lahorgam, they are getting in early to wipe out those terrorists, the same din is abal horgecho. It's a wonderful mitzvah. And that way they won't become insensitive to murder, because they're not murdering, they're saving. And if one had time, one would almost have to stay as one stands with one's rifle aimed at the terrorist moving in the bush. One almost would have to say, Hinani mechavim b'zeh l'shem yichud kutshu brichu, I hereby declare that I'm being mekayim the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh for the sake of the Ribbono Shel Olam, etc., etc. If one had the time to do it that way, that's the way one should do it, and then it would certainly not have any blunting effect on one's own sensitivities. One doesn't have the time to do that, so in between exercises when one's sitting in the camp, that's what one has to do. One has to constantly remind oneself of what one is in fact doing. But the Akedah goes much further. The Akedah says not only is shalom, peace, not a consequence of war, but shalom is a precondition for war. You've got to make it clear before you go into war that the purpose of the war is peace. That's strange. He says something which is clearly obvious, that in wartime one's sensitivity, as this non-Jewish person was saying to me the other day, one's refinement starts deteriorating. Everything becomes mutter. Everything all of a sudden becomes allowed. You're working under pressure. You're fighting for your life. There are all sorts of heterim and you're not quite sure what is mutter and what isn't, what is permitted and what isn't, but all of a sudden everything becomes mutter because you're fighting for your life. And as one's operating in such a jungle atmosphere, one begins to take on the morality of a jungle. And the Akedah says this is one of the dangerous things about a war, is that one's whole perspective gets lost. Now we can see the extent to which this is in fact so by some of the dinim regarding a war. Firstly, in Devarim chapter Kaf Aleph, we're given the dinim before one goes out to war. Chapter Kaf, chapter 20. Firstly, we select the army. So the first thing is all the people are gathered together. And the shoitrim, the leaders of the people, get up and they say, whoever has built a new house and has not yet lived in the house, we don't want that person in our army. Why? Because such a person is not going to be committed to the war effort. He's going to have his mind back home. He's not going to have his mind on the war. So he's not worth anything in the army. On the contrary, he's a nuisance in the army. So he must go home. Anybody who's built a vineyard, planted a vineyard, and hasn't yet introduced the use of the vineyard should also go back. You've just started a business, the business isn't off the ground yet. Your mind is not going to be on the war, your mind is going to be in your business. Go home. You're better off at home. Anybody who has become betrothed with a woman and has not yet married her, same principle, you go home. Don't leave uncompleted major tasks at home, because with that you can't put your mind into the war. And then the Torah says, V'yosfu ha-shoitrim l'daber el ha'om, and the shoitrim should then continue to talk to the people and say, Mi ho'ish hayorei v'rach ha-levov, who is the man who is scared and of soft heart, yelech v'yoshuv l'vesa, he should also go back. We don't need any scaredy babies. And there's a machlokes in the Gemara as to what this fear is talking about. Does that mean that anybody who's scared should go? And the way we take on is, no, Rabbi Yossi Aglili Omer, Hayorei me aveiros shebiyodo. If a man is afraid that he's done aveiros, and therefore he won't merit miracles, he won't be deserving of miracles. So he's afraid that he's going to be killed. So the Torah says, go back with all these other people So nobody knows why you're going back, if it's because you've just been engaged or you've just built a house, whatever it is, you won't embarrass yourself. Off you go. Shelo yavinu shem ba'alei aveiro, so that the people should know that those are the people who have done wrong. And people will think that they're going back for other reasons. So who will we be left with in the army? We have nobody in the army who's just built a new house. We have nobody in the army who has just opened a new business. We have nobody in the army who is newly married. And we have nobody in the army who has done an aveira. So we have an army of tzaddikim. And the maskilim used to tell jokes about this. They used to say, imagine if we followed the system in the modern army of Israel. People would get up, the shochim would get up, and they would say, who's built a new house, etc.? And a few thousand people would go off. Who's just got married? A few thousand people would go off. Who's just built a business, whatever it is? A few thousand people would go off. Who's scared that they've done any aveiras and they might not be saved miraculously? Everybody goes off. And who would you be left with? Three old Jews there. You'll have the Chazanish and the Briskerov. And then the three old Jews there, stooped over their sticks. Who else are you going to have in such an army? If one of the conditions is that you've done nothing wrong. And when the Briskerov heard that joke, he says, they're quite right. That's just what the Jewish armies used to look like. And they used to win their wars. That's what a Jewish army was. So you can imagine the type of people that were left in this army. None of us would have qualified very comfortably with all four conditions. Most of us would have opted out. No matter how keen we would have been to do the mitzvah of fighting this particular war, we would have opted out. And only great tzaddikim would have been left. People who are satisfied that they have no averus for which they haven't done tshuva. That they're clear, that their slate is clean, and that they're fully deserving of any miracles which anybody is likely to receive. Those are the people who are going to be left in the army. Okay, so now we know the army. A little bit further comes an interesting parasha at the beginning of Kitetzer. Now you go out to war on your enemies, and the Ribbono Shelem gives them into your hands, and you're taken captive. And you see in captivity a pretty girl, and you want that pretty girl. So you marry her, v'lokachta l'chol l'isha. You may take the girl for a wife. This is talking about a non-Jewish girl. I mean, just what's going on here? Our army is now an army of great, outstanding people. A couple of old Jews with long beards, tzaddikim. And they go into their army with they're likely to forget their rifle at home, but their Gemara they've got, and the Rambam under the other arm, and off they go. And they get to their first camp, and the commander's looking for them, and where are they? They're davening. So he waits until they finish davening. They finish davening, they sit down, they're learning Chavrusa, they're arguing about a Rambam here, and the Shulchan Aruch there, and what's the halacha, and this and that. Those are the people in the army. Comes the time to meet the enemy, they go into the enemy, and they do very well, and they mop them up, and they take some captives. And one of these tzaddikim falls in love with a little shiksa there. It doesn't make any sense. That's what it is. It's unbelievable what a war situation can do to moral stature. No matter how great you are, when it comes to war, that greatness is in danger. And that greatness can be lost in a moment. It's the most frightening thing. But we've been speaking a little bit about this over the last couple of weeks. And you should have noticed that there are really two themes that I'm busy on at the moment. The one is this terrible threat to losing stature. No matter how great and how high you've climbed, there's the terrible threat of falling, and it can take you 20 years to climb, and you can fall in one moment. That's the one thing. And the second thing we've been discussing is generally the psychology of a Talmid Chacham, just to try and understand. The Talmidei Chachamim don't work the same, they don't tick the same way that other people do. And by the time we're finished with this theme, and it might still take us several more weeks, I think you'll have a much clearer picture of what does make a Talmid Chacham tick, how he does work. He also has a psychology, and he can also fall, as we see, and he can fall terribly low, and he can fall low terribly quickly. Sure he can, but not by the same psychological systems that the psychologists talk about, by completely different systems, but we need to understand those systems. So here we see you can have outstanding people, and push it, they can fall in down to absolutely nothing. And the more one looks at this parasha, the more amazing it is. The Torah asks, how come that the Mefarshim asks, how come that Torah allows such a thing? The Gemara says, "Keneged Yetzer Hara Dibra Torah." The Gemara realizes that a person in such a situation can have such a powerful Yetzer Hara that nothing, no prohibition will help. He's going to do it. So they try and design a system which is likely to discourage him, which is likely to point out to him the folly of what he's doing. But it's Keneged Yetzer Hara Dibra Torah. It's not that the Torah likes this one little bit. What can you do? It has to make provision for reality. And there's discussion that the Chumash talks about Eishes Yifas Toar, a beautiful girl. Look, so maybe if she's extremely beautiful, Chala Godol Michaveira Yitzre Godol Hemenu, a great man appreciates beauty more than an ordinary man does. Don't think that a tzaddik doesn't appreciate beauty. Even beauty in a woman, the greater the man is, the more sophisticated is his taste when it comes to things like this, and the more dangerous is his Yetzer Hara. So then I can understand. But the Ramban brings Chazal that says, no, even if it's Mechueret, the Sifri says, Minayin Afilu Koeret, even if she's an ugly woman. Talmud Loma V'Cheshakta, but talking about the Yetzer Hara, when you're in love, everybody's beautiful. That is. So it talks about Yifat Torah, because to him she's beautiful, even though she might be the most ugly thing out. So who are we talking about? A man of great stature, who could fall in love with a Shiksa who's as ugly as they come. And that's what we're talking about. And the Torah has to make provision. And you can imagine what kind of quality of person. Where did he pick this girl up? Well, she isn't from the nobility of the lands they conquered. He picked her up in the street. It's unbelievable. But those are the depths to which one can drop. And we know that we're talking about tzaddikim because the war is so successful. We're not talking about rapists and people who've gone off their minds. And the Sonoi Hashem Elokecha b'yodecho. The Ribbono Shel'Olam delivers them into your hands. So it's a miraculous war. It's amazing. But we see from here that the Yesod of the Akedah is absolutely right. When it comes to war, one's whole moral system starts collapsing. And one finds oneself in terrible danger, no matter how great one is and how special one is. One finds oneself in terrible danger at times of war. Therefore, says the Akedah, the most important thing to realize is, okay, he says an amazing thing. Just imagine what the generals in the army would say to such a thing. When you fight a war, says the Akedah, don't fight for the principle. That you don't fight for. Because if you fight for the principle, you'll become a murderer, chas v'shalom. And not just a murderer in war. You'll end up murdering your friends as well. Because if you're prepared to kill somebody because you believe your principle is right, what are you going to do when you're arguing in the street in peacetime with somebody? And he says he's right and you say you're right. Are you going to go and kill him? You don't have a right to kill another person on principle because you believe you're right. That's not the basis for a war. Don't gear yourself to the principle of the whole thing. Don't fight on principle, says the Akedah. And I want to read to you the relevant passage of the Akedah. In war, inevitably, there are bad things and sin. We see from the parasha that I've just read to you, in wartime, it's terrible. There's nothing romantic about war. There's nothing glorious about war. It's a terrible thing. It has to be done sometimes, but it's terrible. It's not possible that a man will choose and involve himself in war as an end in itself. Ki asher ken yibchar, because if such a man will choose such a thing, yikorei oshek, then he's called an oppressor, v'roteach, and a murderer, v'gam hu yovoi lidei sinas habrios kulon, and he will come to hatred of humanity. That's what the next step is. You're so geared to hate those enemies that you're busy fighting. And why do you hate them? Because they oppose your principles that you believe are right. And so you develop a hatred for them, and he says, not only is it certainly you'll develop hatred for those who you're fighting against, but but you'll even develop hatred for your brothers and your relatives and your acquaintances, Hayotim B'tzivosov, who come out to fight, Kihem Yahabchilo L'Oyovim, they'll become enemies of his. V'yilchamu Imoy, and they'll fight with him. Because there are going to be arguments on matters of principle. Whenever people are interrelating, there are arguments. And if you've taken it upon yourself that you have the right to fight and to kill and to hate, because you believe you're right and you believe they're wrong, where are you going to draw the boundary line? Why am I allowed to go and shoot the terrorist over there? Well, let's not talk about terrorism, because that's a particular nature of war. But let's talk in the Second World War, whatever it is. A Frenchman standing on the boundary line fighting a German. Now, what's the German? I don't know if any of you saw the film that was recently done with a German sympathy. A very beautiful film. I've forgotten the name. Does anybody remember it? All Quiet on the Western Front. I hope everybody saw it. Doesn't look like it. Well, basically what comes out is, you know, they're all professional soldiers, this side, that side. What's the difference? And you have a scene there which is the crux of the whole thing, where a German soldier is running and this firing starts on him, so he dives into one of these craters, one of these bomb craters, and he waits and he hides there. And the fighting and the shooting's going on, and he waits and he waits, and a French soldier dives into the same pit and doesn't see him for a moment, and he takes out his bayonet and he goes and he kills the French soldier. It takes the French soldier a little while to die, and you see the agony and the moral torture that this German soldier is undergoing. Finally the French soldier dies, and he takes out the identity documents from the pockets of the French soldier, and he sees his name is XYZ, and he's got a photograph of his wife and his children. He says to the dead body there, says, do you understand what you're fighting for? Do I understand what I'm fighting for? I've got a family at home, you've got a family. Who? What's going on here? Killing each other. Over what? And that's a war where there was purpose, and where there was idealism, and where there was wickedness. But nevertheless, just leave out the Jewish factor of it, and leave out the Hitlerism at the moment. Germany and France at war, as they have been for centuries and centuries. A German soldier fighting a French soldier. The German soldier believes his right, the French soldier believes his right. That gives them the right to murder. Whoever gets to the next one first can kill. And when the French meets another Frenchman, or an Englishman, or the German meets another German or a Russian, and they're sitting over a beer and they're having a discussion and they disagree with each other, and it's important, or if they're doing a business deal and the Frenchman realizes that if he doesn't kill the Englishman, the Englishman is going to get the better of him in the business deal, why shouldn't he kill him? Where is the morality that says you can in war and you can't in peace? Since the Akedah, that's what starts becoming indistinguishable. And the man who's fighting for a cause is a man who's going to become a hater by nature. He'll become a Seinei Habrius. He'll hate anybody who disagrees with him. And that's a terrible midah. When that starts happening, that one develops sinah for people who disagree with one, the whole world stops operating, as it has done. He develops it a little bit. Therefore, he says, the attitude one has to take is, what we want is peace. That's it. And we're prepared to negotiate peace before we start fighting. We don't want a war. You don't declare war, you declare peace. Let the other one declare war. You never declare war. You declare peace. You've got to give the enemy the opportunity to make peace with you and to achieve the desired result without going through the long, destructive, endless method of war, which ultimately achieves nothing at all. Because one wins and one loses, and then the two carry on cooperating as if nothing happened afterwards. That's ultimately what happens. So there's just a lot of bloodshed in between. That's not the way to do it. The purpose, says the Akedah, is shalom. The whole basis is peace. You've got to say, war was unavoidable. You must, when you go into war, you must be able to say to yourself, war is unavoidable. It's clear that Ribono Shel Olam wants us to fight. We tried everything we could to avoid it. Couldn't be avoided. So war is unavoidable. But what are we fighting for? We're not fighting for an ideal. We're not fighting for capitalism. We're not fighting for anti-communism. We're fighting for peace. That's what we're fighting for. And we'll fight until there can be peace. But the moment there can be peace, we'll stop fighting. Therefore, says the Akedah, even though they knew, Moshe knew, that there was no way that Sichon would make peace, even though God had told him, you're going to conquer that land, and you're going to win the war, and you're going to battle with them, and you're going to settle that land. Nevertheless, Moshe had to start with a suggestion for peace. Says the Akedah, not just because of politeness and diplomacy, but so that the soldiers themselves would remember at all times, we're fighting for peace. Peace is what started the whole thing, and peace is what's going to end the whole thing. And that's what we're fighting for. That's why the Yesod, the foundation of the whole war, has to be peace. And even if you know there's no chance of peace, the first step has to be peace. It's an amazing thing. And in order to understand it, one has to understand what Shalom means. Because one thing you see already, that Shalom is something worth fighting for. It's an amazing thing. Peace is worth having a war about. Something that you sometimes do have to have a war about. Now Kedah says, by the way, he brings the Sifri, that even with the Shira Sa'amim, even with the seven nations who had to be utterly wiped out when they conquered Canaan, even there the Torah says, the reason for wiping them out is Laman Asher Lo Yelamdu Eschem La'asos K'chol Te'avosom, so that they shouldn't teach you to do like all their abominations Asher Osu Le'Eloheim, which they did to their gods, V'chatosim La'Hashem Elokeichem, and you will land up sinning to God. Therefore, says the Sifri, since the whole reason for exterminating the seven nations is that we should not learn from them, what would happen if the seven nations volunteer to do tshuva? They say, look, don't wipe us out, but we'll get rid of all our idols, and we'll live like Gerei Toshav, we'll attach ourselves to you, and we'll keep the Shiva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, we'll keep the seven Noachide laws, leave us alone, says the Sifri, we would have left them. They always have the option of peace. We've never gone to war with a nation without giving them the option of peace. And they didn't even have to do anything terrible to achieve the peace. They didn't have to be humiliated to achieve the peace. They just had to take a step to monotheistic morality. They would have accepted monotheistic morality, which is something everybody is capable of understanding. We could have discussed it with them, taught it to them, proved it to them, and they would have accepted it. They wouldn't have been wiped out. So even with the Shiva Ta'omim, says the Akedah, the purpose was peace, and we start off asking them to do tshuva, only if they refuse to do tshuva do we have to wipe them out. What is Shalom? Shalom is not a lack of conflict. The Gemara says in Yevamos Daf Samach Beis that Kol Asher Shorei Beloi Isho Shorei Beloi Shalom. If a man is unmarried, if a man is without a wife, he's without peace. It's a very strange Gemara. I can understand a Gemara that says a man is without a wife, he's lonely, he's miserable, he'll have no food to eat, he'll have no company, his home will be dull and boring, anything like that I would understand. But judging by the marriage counseling normality, to say that he's surely without peace doesn't seem right. There are many benefits to marriage. It's a wonderful institution. But I don't know of a successful marriage that's gone through peacefully from beginning to end. Every marriage has its arguments, its difficulties, its problems, its conflicts. There are times when they're at each other's throats. You can't believe it sometimes, the fighting that goes on. Sometimes happens. What does it mean? Shalom is not sitting alone as a bachelor, as a spinster. That's not shalom. That's opting out. That's not operating. Shalom can only be when there are two parties, when there's more than one party. Shalom comes from the word sholem, from the word whole, complete. Now there are two ways a thing can be complete, either because it's integral, it's only one unit, and it's complete, or it's more than one unit, but the two or more units create something which is complete. Now we have a situation where the only thing in the world which is integral is the Ribbono Shel Olam. there is nothing else in the world which is indivisible. When you come down to the final indivisibility, you've come down to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, the Ribbono Shel Olam is one, and nobody else is one. The concept of oneness, of being complete and integral, that we don't have in the physical world other than the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. So God is the unique thing which is one unit and consequently complete. Everything else is a harmony. Everything else is a combination of factors. No matter how far you go down, you start with a book. The book is made of a cover and pages and printing on it content. And you'll analyze the pages and it's made from various materials. And you'll analyze the materials and it's made from molecules. And you'll analyze the molecules and it's made from atoms. And you'll analyze the atoms and it's got electrons and neutrons. And you'll analyze those and there's still smaller things. And so you'll go on. Until you get to the very bottom, you'll get to a spot of godliness in it. But until you get to the godliness in it, it's always divisible. You can always take it down further and further and further. So when you've got more than one factor operating to produce one unit, the book is one unit, but it's made of many things, then you can't have shleimus, you can't have perfection without having shalom, without having peace between the various factors that constitute the item. Because if the factors are pulling apart in different directions, then the book would fall to pieces. That's where we need shalom. So shalom really is the ability to draw together different factors to create a unit, to create one concept. And I think the area where one can most appreciate what shalom means is orchestral music. Watch an orchestra. And you can analyze and analyze and analyze. And its violins, and its violas, and its cellos, and its double basses. And it's the woods, and it's the brass, and it's the percussion. And each section can be subdivided. In the woods you've got your oboes and your bassoons and your other little things there. And your brasses you've got your trumpets and your trombones and your French horns and all of those. And in the percussion you've got all your different types of drums. And you can have a massive orchestra where there are 50 or 60 violins or more than that. And 20 violas and 10 cellos, you can have a huge orchestra. And now all these people sit on the stage. And they're going to create one harmonic piece of music. They're going to create one unit which people are going to listen to, and only with great skill and knowledge will they be able to divide it into sections. But the layman who sits and listens will be listening to one piece of art. That's it. That's how there can be shalom. You can have all these different instruments, each playing different tunes, sounding completely different, in slightly different keys, creating one complete unit, one piece of music. And one has to understand when one's talking with regards to peace among nations, that's really what one's talking about. The only way there can possibly be peace between nations is when the nations see themselves as functioning as part of a massive orchestra. The moment there's encroachment, there's no longer peace. If the orchestra is silent for a moment's pause, and then the violins are supposed to come in, and then the cellos, and then the double basses, and then the brass, and just as that pause is ready and the violinists are getting ready to go, the brass comes in, then you're finished. The whole thing is over. Just one moment's encroachment, but that's not your territory. The only way there can be peace is by strict adherence to territory, strict adherence to limited areas of operation, and seeing yourself as part of something much bigger than you. A person who sees and plays in the orchestra, all he can see is the violins, and he can't see beyond that, he's going to want to play as loud as possible that everybody should hear the violins, and he's going to want to come in fractionally before he should so that everybody will hear the perfection of his tone. And he'll want to keep a note going one moment longer than he should so that again everybody will notice him, and you've got the end of it. That can't function. He has to understand that the only way there can be shalom and therefore shleimus is by ruthless adherence to the principles of border integrity. That's how far you can go. You can't go further. Ein Malchus Nugas Bechavetu. One kingdom mustn't touch another kingdom. There can be no overlapping when you're coming to this kind of operation. And so when nations are functioning together, or wish to function together, which is the only way they can function, because no nation is entirely independent, if there's the tiniest bit of encroachment, the shalom is gone. And the only way you can avoid the encroachment is by ensuring that each nation understands its borders, not just physical borders, but its functional borders, and sees itself as part of the big orchestra, and finds its fulfillment not only from its own perfection, but finds its fulfillment from the role it's playing in the whole orchestra called this little world. That's the orchestra. And by contributing to the all-round totality of perfection, that's how a nation should acquire a throne. Not because our GNP is the greatest, not because our defense force is the greatest, not because our foreign exchange reserves are the highest. That's not what gives a nation, or what should give a nation, a thrill. The thrill should come from what we've been able to do to enrich the world in which humanity lives. That's how it has to be seen. And for that there has to be a Ribono Shel Olam. A nation that's not prepared to accept the authority of the conductor is not going to be able to stick within his limits. And the moment there's no acceptance of a Ribono Shel Olam, each nation is going to want to encroach 1 millimeter even out of its territory. And then you've got war. Then Shalom is over. So Am Yisrael come to Sichon and they say, look here, Sichon, if you want to operate with us, you've got to understand the score. Let's go through the score. Let's look at the musical score and see what's happening here. We're a part of the orchestra. And it's not that we're more important. The violins might be the body of the orchestra. Maybe we're going to reach the crescendo of the piece in this particular symphony. But your support is going to be so important. Without your support, the whole piece is not going to sound right. Now, if you'll accept that that's our function, and if you'll accept that if we follow the score, we, the people of Israel, are going to be moving from this point where we are over to that point on the other side of your territory. Now there are two ways we can do it, Sichon. Either you and we can make music in harmony, and that will be the quickest, most efficient, most beautiful way of doing it. And then you're a partner of ours. Then we're working together. You have contributed to our settlement in Eretz Yisrael. You become a friend, you become an ally, you work with us. Or we have to go the long way around. Or we have to fight you. Which is not the way the score reads. That's when the Akedah talks about giving a nation the option of shalom. That's what he means. Not just peace at any price. Shalom meaning shleimus. Do you want to partake in a grand scheme in which every nation has a part to play? Do you want shalom? Do you want to live together with us, to work with us, to struggle with us, to overcome challenges with us, in terms of the broad outline outlined by the Ribono Shel Olam in his symphonic score? Or do you believe that you're outside the orchestra, in which case there can't be shalom? A nation that doesn't see itself as part of the total structure cannot accept peace. And that's the option which is given to Sichon. It's the option that was given to Moab. It's the option that is given to the Shevas Ha'omim. We say, look, we're going to live in Canaan. It says here in the score. That's our function. We're going to live in your nation, in your country. You're welcome to stay. But you've got to live with morality. That's the choice. Do you want to be part of the score? Do you want to live moral lives together with us and make music with us? Or don't you see yourselves as part of the orchestra? You don't see yourselves as part of the orchestra, there has to be a fight. Because shalom isn't the avoidance of war. A family, a husband and wife who skillfully avoid arguments, or a husband and wife who are living next to each other, not with each other. A husband and wife who don't argue, or a husband and wife who are not married. There has to be an argument, but that argument needn't be a danger to shalom bias. They can be shlemus even with arguments. Here too, just to say, okay, Canaan, you don't want to adopt our system of morality, we don't want to fight. We're people of peace. That's Christian thought, that's not Jewish thought. Jewish thought is shalom is not the absence of war. Shalom is harmony. And for harmony you need two different bodies vibrating in different ways according to the directions of a score to play a part in one symphonic piece, not doing your own thing. If you want to play the part in the piece, you'll be part of the symphony. If you don't, you've got to be eliminated from the symphony. We can't have you sitting in the orchestra playing your own music. You have to be thrown out. If you're stronger than me, you'll throw me out. Let's fight. That's what a war is. But the purpose of the war is to reinstate Shlemus, to reinstate Shalom, to have the enemy playing his part, not to eliminate him totally. The first prize is to have the enemy playing in the orchestra. You don't want him out. If he's out, there's a gap. Says the Akedah, that's why every war has to start with a request, with a plea for Shalom, for real peace, not just for the avoidance of conflict, but for the operating together which constitutes real Shalom. Once we have that principle, then it's easy to understand a lot of things. The one thing that it's easy to understand is interpersonal relationships too. We have no right to hate somebody who disagrees with us. Why is my basis for a machlokes, that's not a basis for an argument. The only basis for the argument is if they're playing out of tune. That's it. And the question is, look here, are you part of the orchestra or not? Now you might have an argument as to interpretation. So the violinist says, look, I don't believe I'm playing out of tune. I believe that's what the conductor wants. If you look at the score and you go back to his first edition and his later corrected editions and this and that, I believe that's what he wants. And the conductor or the soloist or the viola player says, no, that's not what he wants. That's not war. That's what the Gemara talks calls machlokes shesofo lehiskayen, which is a very strange phrase. The Mishnah talks about a machlokes shesofo lehiskayen, a machlokes which is l'shem shemayim will last, and a machlokes which is not l'shem shemayim ain't sofo lehiskayen, it won't last. Who wants a machlokes to last? It should be the other way around. The machlokes which is l'shem shemayim will get over, and a machlokes which is not l'shem shemayim, you'll never get over that. No, it's the other way around. If it's a good machlokes, it'll last forever. And if it's not a good machlokes, it won't last forever. There's only one way you can eliminate machlokes. That you have to fight. There needs to be war. And somebody has to be rooted out. Somebody has to be expelled. Somebody has to be kicked out. Ultimately. If both sides believe so strongly that they're prepared to risk their olam habo and their olam hazeh in a fight, where is there going to be a solution until one has won, until somebody has been victorious? So victory in terms of routing out the enemy can only take place if it's a machlokes shelo l'shem shemayim. But if it's an argument between the viola players and the violin players, that argument will persist forever and ever. The violin players will always believe that's the way to play it, and the viola players will always believe that's the way to play it, but there's halacha. The deciding factor is the conductor. Have your argument, and you can still believe you're right, and you can still believe you're right, but this orchestra plays this way, and that's how we're doing it. If you're playing with another orchestra, you can try it your way. But that's the halach. It doesn't mean you're wrong, Mr. Violinist, and it doesn't mean you're wrong, Mr. Viola Player. It just means that the conductor will decide how it's going to be played. And that's a machlokes l'shem shemayim. When we're arguing about how the symphony needs to be played, but we accept that we're in the orchestra, that's a machlokes shesofo lehiskayem. That's a wonderful machlokes. It creates richness of communal relationship, creates richness among people, and it creates a richness within a community. But there has to be clarity in one's mind. Is one in the orchestra or out of the orchestra? And if one's in the orchestra, one has to play within the limits. And therefore, when one has an argument with a person, one has to decide, am I arguing my view against his? That is the akedah I have no right to argue about. That's sinas chinam. Elamai, the only argument I'm entitled to have is, I'm looking at the score, and I take out the Shulchan Aruch and Chazal, and I say, look, I'm a Jew, and this is what the score says. This is the way we should be doing. Then my question to my opponent is, look, do you accept the score? Are you part of the Shulchan Aruch? Are you prepared to sit and discuss the matter and come to a halachic conclusion as to what is right for the orchestra to play? Or are you telling me that you're not going to be bound by all this? If you're not going to be bound by all this, then it's war. Then it's a machlokes, then it's a different type of machlokes. But the purpose of the war is to come back to peace. The purpose of war is not to excommunicate. And the purpose of war is not to make the person feel out of it. The purpose of the war is to ultimately bring him back. It's a war where you mekarev, it's a war of bringing in, not a war of pushing aside. And within our Jewish communities today, we have to be very careful to understand that. Take Reform and Orthodox as an example. There can be no compromise. Basically, the question is not how to interpret the score. The question is, Reform does not want to play in the orchestra. They want to do their own thing and still be called part of the orchestra. That can't be. So we have to fight. But the purpose of the fight is shalom. The purpose of the fight is to have them back in playing the right piece, not to have them excommunicated and out. And that's a very difficult fight to involve oneself. To fight for peace is so much more difficult than to fight for victory. But we must never fight for victory. Victory is unimportant. We've got to fight for peace. We've got to fight for shlemus. That applies not only in intercommunal matters, it applies in interpersonal matters. What is your argument about? If you're having an argument with somebody, clarify the issue. Are you arguing about interpretation of the symphony? Or are you arguing about whether you're in or you're out? If you're arguing about interpretation, there is halacha. Go and ask your rabbi what the answer is. If you're arguing about in or out, that's no argument. That's war. But the war has to be to bring the man back. And there are all funny ways of fighting a war. One doesn't have to fight a war aggressively. One can fight a war in all sorts of sneaky methods. One can lull an opponent into a sense of false security. One can make him feel more comfortable than he should be feeling. One can bring him into one's home skillfully. And one can slowly start teaching him and convincing him that his greatest fulfillment will be to pick up his violin and to play the score as it says in the book. But that requires such skill, and it requires such gadlus, it requires such human greatness. But that's what the Torah is about. The thing that bothers me so much in modern Yiddishkeit is how we're just throwing over the demands of Torah. We're chapping all the easy things, and believe me, to become frum, as difficult as it is, that's easy. And even to learn Torah is relatively easy. To sit and learn is relatively easy, and it's fun, it's stimulating, it's intellectually rewarding. The difficulty is to build oneself up and to build and to make a mensch of oneself. And here you see the type of demands which are made on a person. It's not just be a nice guy and know how to smile and know how to say good morning. That's not shalom. Shalom is the ability to fight a war for peace and to win the war for peace. Not to win a victory, but to win peace. That's something one needs gadlus for. One needs to be a great man. One needs to be a great human being in order to fight such a war. Now you'll understand also why the only people we want in that army are tzaddikim. We don't want nobody else is capable of fighting in an army that is charged with a task such as the one we've just described. An ordinary man can't do it. And lastly, there are wars within ourselves too. There are wars between nations. There are wars between communities. There are wars among individuals. And there are wars constantly within each individual. Each human being is filled with a mass of conflicts, of difficulties and of tensions. And again, a human being who doesn't have those tensions is like a married couple who doesn't have an argument. There's something wrong. They're not alive. A living human being, a human being whose passions are alive, is a human being who has conflict and tension. He has his passions versus his intellect. He has his feelings versus his analysis. He has his different kinds of feelings. He has desires sometimes to be hateful and desires to be kind. He desires to be extrovert and have lots of friends, and he desires to withdraw to himself and be quietly on his own. He desires to be ambitious and important, and he desires to be anonymous. all these conflicts over and over again. He has different roles to play. He's a family man and he's a businessman, and that creates a conflict. To do successfully, successful in your business. There was a very lovely article written recently that somebody showed me, proving that the decline of economics is directly resultant from the increase in permissiveness. But not the way that one would expect the proof to be carried out. The argument was simply the following. In old times, if a married couple were unhappy, what was the solution? The husband went to work a little harder, came home a little later, left home a little earlier, and the wife took a job too. And that encouraged productivity. And there were big families. And you didn't want to come home to tens of children screaming in your ears, so you stayed in your office a little bit longer. And you made your office a little bit more comfortable. So if you bought yourself a bar, you installed it in your office, not in your house. And you had your newspaper delivered to the office, not to the house. And if you wanted a stereo set, you had to put it in your office, not in your house. Because you would be disturbed in your house with all the children and with a nagging wife. So you stay in the office a little bit longer. With the advent of permissiveness, this article claimed, now if you have problems with your wife, you just drop her and you take a mistress. Now you sit in the office all day wondering about when you can get back to your mistress. And when it's a question now of where you have your drink, you certainly don't have it in your office. You sneak home a little bit earlier to get to the mistress. And the mistress wouldn't think of working because you're supporting her very nicely in any case. And when you get bored with her, you drop her and take another one. So the offices are emptying out. That was the argument of this particular article. Be that as it may, the point that it makes is that the demands of successful moral family life and the demands of a successful business or professional life are at loggerheads with each other most of the time. It's not easy to reconcile them. And the demands of a religious life on top of that, where does that fit in? And in the different roles we have to play, so you go to your business and you're a big managing director, big guy. And then you come to yeshiva in the afternoon to sit and you're learning half a day, and you're a little Talmud sitting, you know the least of everybody there. It creates tremendous tension in a human being. And then back the next day, you're the big guy exerting authority, and the next moment you're taking authority. There are different roles to play. We're playing in different symphonies all the time, and we're switching from one to the other, playing a violin one moment and a double bass at the next moment and a drum the next moment, in completely different styles of music. And these tensions build up in a human being, and he finds it difficult to take it. And it's like the shiur we had, I think it was 2 weeks ago, so when he's at home, and he's having a bit of trouble at home, he thinks about how his business, that's his real life. And when he's in business and things aren't going well, he thinks, it doesn't matter, Baruch Hashem, I've got a nice family. And wherever he is, he thinks that his real life is on the other side of the road. And he chases his tail round and round in circles, never really living, always believing that what he's doing now is just the means to be able to do the next thing. And the tension builds up and builds up and builds up, and he never relaxes as a real living human being. One's at war with oneself. There are different parts of the individual that are constantly warring and fighting, passions raging within one, and all these passions have to be brought to a state of shalom. One has to bring it to peace somehow. One has to get, if one's going to be victorious in the war, victory is shalom, victory is not routing. You know, it's a strange thing. If you look at some of the very tranquil things in the world, take a river. People go fishing. And they sit on the side of a torrential river. And they'll tell you how relaxing and tranquil it is. And they're right, it's beautiful. And the sound of the water flowing over the rocks, and the ripples and the reflections in the water, and watching the currents, and you watch pieces of wood and leaf flowing down the river. It doesn't matter if you catch a fish or not. That's not what you're there for. You're there for the tranquility of the sight and the sound of what you're doing. And you ask, if a man was drowning in the river, would he find it so tranquil? If a man was trying to swim, if a man fell out of a boat in that river, would that be so tranquil? It's not tranquil at all. There are gushing torrents, there are currents, there are anti-currents. There are boulders and rocks, there are waterfalls, it can be a vicious place to be in. And in that same viciousness, just 2 feet away from it, you're busy struggling against currents in the most nightmarish situation of turbulence you've ever been in. And there you see a man sitting, gazing into the sky, taking in, he hasn't noticed you, he's just taking in the tranquility of it all. And a few yards further down, you'll find an artist painting the tranquility. Each man finding his tranquility in something which is inherently most untranquil. Take a watch, a clock. Tick, tock, tick, tock. So tranquil and peaceful. Grandfather clocks. You know, when you buy a little puppy, they tell you put a clock under its pillow. Put it to sleep. They tell you to do the same with babies. It doesn't work, but they tell you to do it. It's supposed to be very tranquil and peaceful. Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick. It's lovely. It's just beautiful. And if you look behind the watch, wheels within wheels, turning, different speeds, gears, ticking, tocking, this way, that way. Not tranquil at all. But that's shalom. Shalom is not stagnancy. Shalom is not death. Shalom is a turbulence which can create an outer tranquility. It's a turbulence inside which leaves the whole tranquil. The river is tranquil. It's very peaceful. It's just that it's made up of different currents. Each current is not tranquil. But the final result, as you see it and look at it, that's tranquil. And if you don't break it up and you don't interfere with it and you don't take one current and try and push it against another current, it's tranquil and peaceful. And a clock is peaceful. It does tick and tock so smoothly and so tranquilly because each wheel is doing its function properly to create the totality which is one of tranquility. And there we have the secret of shalom. Shalom is something very positive that needs tremendous sweat and labor to achieve. Menuchas nefesh, when one's talking about relaxation. Relaxation is not the transcendental meditation kind of relaxation. Get everything out of your head and do nothing, and you'll be relaxed. That's what we do, chas v'sholem, at the end of 120 years. Everything's out of our heads, and we do nothing, and they put us down under, and we lie tranquilly. That's fine. But that's not life. That's not tranquil living. The Gemara in Brochus says you've got to be very careful how you greet a person. If you're greeting a dead person, you say, Lech b'sholem, go in peace. If you're greeting a live person, you say, Lech l'sholem, go to peace. Lech l'sholem indicates movement. You are busy moving in the direction of peace. Lech b'sholem is you're in peace already. You've arrived, you're there, you're stagnant. And b'sholem indicates deathliness, whereas l'sholem indicates aliveness and dynamicism. And one has to understand that tranquility is a factor of dynamics. It's not a factor of relaxation. One can only achieve tranquility and shalom through dynamics. If there's one wheel in the watch that's not turning, you won't hear that tranquil tick-tock. If there's one wheel which has taken the day off and relaxing, the whole watch ceases to be tranquil. If there's one current which isn't operating properly, or if a barrier is put up against one part of the river loses its tranquility. If one musical instrument misses one beat, the whole orchestra loses its tranquility. Human being is made up of so many different parts, and that's what makes him rich. And the only way he can be tranquil is when all those parts are working. But they've got to be working b'shlemus. They've got to be working as part of an orchestra. Two things are necessary. All the parts of you have to be operating, and they have to be operating to form an integral whole. They can't all be going off on their different directions. It all has to tie up. It all has to be making one harmonious piece of music. Can't be making different noises. And that becomes the difficulty and the problem of living. Once we've got out of our mind that tranquility is not going to come through relaxation, then we say, but then how can we reach tranquility? The more busy we are, the more difficult it is to reach tranquility, and the more elusive is tranquility. Sure, because we're busy in a very peculiar way. We're busy in separate ways. We're doing different things which are all disorientated and disjointed. There's no connection between the one thing we're doing and the other. And the reason is because we're doing it all far too superficially. When you look at things on the surface, they're disconnected. If you look at the watch on the top, there's no connection between the big hand and the little hand and the second hand. There's no connection. Certainly if you look on these digital watches, no connection between one figure and the next figure. And when one figure changes and a one becomes a two, the one is gone and now there's a two. Different thing altogether. It's only when you look down deep and you understand how the watch is functioning that you begin to see that at the Makor it's all one, it's a watch. And there's an ingenious mind behind this watch. There's a designer and an engineer who put it together, each thing in its exact position, each perfectly molded to fulfill one particular function. And then the whole thing was set in motion, where each little gear is forming its function properly to create one clock. One has to be able to see one's life in that kind of light. One has to be able to see one's life as one clock, not as a million different gear wheels. And the only way one can do that is by living on a much deeper level than we tend to live. Because when you're living in depth, firstly, does it matter that much if you're in your office, or you're in your home, or you're in the shul, or you're in the Beis HaMedrash? Does it really matter that much? If the clock is your Avodas Hashem, if you've decided what your function in the world is, if you've taken yourself to pieces to understand what is expected of you and where you're trying to get, and there's no other ambition apart from Avodas Hashem which can take in all one's passions. A business ambition can't take care of all one's human needs and talents. A family involvement can't take care of all one's human needs and involvements. There is no other occupation other than Avodas Hashem which can take in all your needs and talents. There is no other. But once one's settled with that and one's worked out what one's Avodas Hashem is, this is what God wants from me over the next 6 months or year or 10 years, this is what I'm working towards. Does it matter where I'm working? Place now doesn't become very relevant. Does it matter if the gear is on the top part of the watch or the bottom part of the watch, or it's behind the 3 or it's behind the 9? Or will we say it's more important because it's behind the 9 than it is if it's behind the 3? It's just irrelevant. Because the only place that is important now is the place occupied by the entire watch. And so what's important now is your life, not the position where you happen to be today. That's not what's important. And each fits into the other, and each functions with the other, if one's living deeply. If you're walking down the road deeply, and your thinking is operating on a deep level, and your sensitivity is operating on a deep level, the things you'll notice, the things you'll think of, it's simply a continuation of what you have been doing, and a preliminary to what you're going to be doing. And if you're reading the newspaper, or you're watching a good film, or reading a good book, but you're doing it with depth and understanding and sensitivity, it's simply a continuation of the same growth process. You're looking for the same things. You're battling with the same things. You're solving the same things. And more important, when you're doing anything in depth, it makes no difference what, if you're doing anything in depth, in real depth, at that moment you're using everything. That's how we are. When you're busy being creative, if an artist is busy painting, if a writer is just busy developing his thought, it's just all coming together. If a businessman is just busy putting the last touches to a most complex business deal, then the whole thing will handle together. Or a lawyer is just busy drafting something particularly meticulous and delicate, and it's also just coming right, and he's being extremely creative in what he's foreseeing and how he's avoiding it. There you're not just using your brain, there you're using your everything. And you sweat, and it hurts, and it's hard, but it's everything. You're not at war. There's shalom. With all that hardness, with all that sweat, you're relaxed. That's the only time that you really are relaxed, is when you're doing something deep, when you're doing something creative, when you're doing something that demands total application. And one shouldn't reserve total application for the few crisis events that happen to happen from time to time. Total application is something one can train oneself to use more and more frequently. One can't start living on that degree of intensity overnight all day. One can start little by little making efforts to introduce that kind of depth and intensity into more things that one does day by day, to ensure that at the end of the day there's more of a feeling of fulfillment, that there's a more of a feeling that all my different gears have been working today. And finally comes the head, the intellect, the conductor of the whole orchestra. We have passions. But because we don't have a good conductor, we like to keep those passions subdued. It's like an orchestra that doesn't have a conductor and everybody's scared to play. And only when they can't control themselves anymore will the kettle drum player will finally take his hammer and beat the drum and break it into smithereens out of pure frustration. Why? Because there's no conductor. If there would have been a conductor, the whole orchestra would have been playing, and he would have been playing his part, and he would have been happy in the contribution he was making to the sound, and he wouldn't have smashed his kettle drum. And we do the same. Because our conductors are not always on duty, we like to subdue our passions in case we do things we shouldn't do, and we're right to. We have to subdue our passions if there's no conductor, but why should there be no conductor? Once we have a conductor, once we have a head that is able to harmonize these passions, to put each one in its place, to give one a little patch when it's going a little bit too far, to encourage one a little bit when it's not going far enough, to say to oneself, you're not feeling sensitive enough in this area, or you're feeling over enthusiastic in that area, cool it a little bit, just slowly, step by step. Whatever it is, each step that one takes, if one has a head on one's shoulders, which is able simply to conduct, not to make the music and not to stifle the music, just to conduct the music, we'll find that those passions are feeling much more relaxed. They're prepared to come out a little bit. They're prepared to utilize themselves a little bit. They're prepared to try and to experiment and to give of their best, knowing that somebody's watching and somebody's not going to let them go too far. But that kind of security we owe our passions, with a sharp intellect and a sharp mind. What we're talking about is, number one, recognizing that we're at war, that we're constituted of warring factions, that we have to fight this war, and fighting this war means winning for Sholem. Peace has to be achieved, and peace doesn't mean stagnancy, peace means richness. Peace means that the orchestra is playing to the full, and for that your passions need to be operating, all of them, everything has to be operating. One has to be capable of feeling cruel, capable of feeling kind, even at the same time. Capable of feeling ambitious, capable of feeling withdrawn. Capable of feeling extrovert, capable of feeling introvert. Capable of feeling social, capable of feeling antisocial. All at the same time, if necessary. With a very astute mind that is watching all the time. And just as the art of music making is the ability to listen and say, no. That blast of the French horn was just a half a second too long. That interferes with the whole music. Let's try it again now, and a half a second shorter. And you try it again, and you say, that's still not right. There's something else wrong. Ah, those violins just subsided too early. Let's try it again. French horn, you stay out again for half a second, and our violins just a little bit higher. Let's have that again. And the music maker, the skillful music maker, is the one who finally said, now that is just perfect. That's how it must be. And that's what we're meant to be doing with our lives all the time. Listening, watching, checking, redoing if necessary, replaying, cutting down where one has to cut down, increasing and embellishing where one has to embellish, to make sure that the final result, whether it's the result of one action, don't forget one action is constituted of millions and millions of parts. Parts in the physical action, the movement of an arm, one can break down into each millimeter. Of the way the arm is moved, just the physical movement. Never mind the feelings it's expressing. Never mind the thought behind it. Never mind all the passions that are being controlled and expressed in that movement of the arm. Millions and millions of factors just into the movement of an arm. How much more so into bigger things and more serious things. This mind of ours has to be able to break things down into their main components and realign them and juggle with them, so that each action develops a degree of beauty, that each action develops shalom and shlemus, that most important of all, when you take each of us as total human beings, looking at all our actions, all the things we say, all the expressions we make, all the things we do, it all ties up together to make a shlemus, to make a perfection, resulting from a state of shalom, a state of peace, not stagnancy, rich peace between all the parts that make us human.